Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Thursday, June 25th, 1998. In the Creekside room this morning is Gene Mugg. Today's session number is 98-1, and it's titled On Holy Ground, The Gift of Hospice Care in the Final Stages of Life. Let's listen in.
I'm sorry, but there is approximately 1 minute delay here before the session starts on this tape. Your patience is appreciated. Thanks.
The meaning of life, and so I just consider that holy ground. But I'd like to tell you a few stories, and then I'd like to go through kind of a case study, follow one patient through the whole process, to let you know exactly what we can provide in hospice, and also then let you know a little bit about how it's paid for and a little bit about the challenges that we face. I was going to do a session tomorrow. I'm having to leave earlier than I anticipated, and I was going to do a session tomorrow and talk about this book, Final Gifts. And I will allude to some things today from here, but this is an absolutely wonderful book. It gives a lot of stories and a lot of information about what happens when a person comes close to death and the kind of messages that a dying person may convey to their family and how to interpret those. They're often interpreted as confusion, and the family doesn't know what to think. When you look at what they're saying more closely, they're saying some important things that can help in the communication and help in the saying goodbye in the last days of life. So this has just a lot of good information. I heartily recommend it. And of course, the author is Maggie Callanan and Patricia Kelly, and they're both they both had years of experience as hospice nurses, and did a lot of research into the cause of confusion at the end of life, and the restlessness and anxiety that we often see, and in very many cases could not find a physical reason for it. So they really looked to see what they were really saying and what that really meant. I'll just give you, it starts out with a story of an elderly couple who had met in their later years. They were both widow and widower. And they met and both discovered they loved traveling. And so they married probably in their 70s and did quite a bit of traveling together. But that was cut short because she developed cancer. And he was very dependent on her, though, because he was getting a little, having some signs of dementia and really dependent on her a lot. And after she was diagnosed, they had about 4 good months together, but then she started to decline, and she was admitted into the hospice program. She was at home, but the hospice nurse started visiting at home. And towards the end, the nurse came one day, and the husband was very upset because his wife was kind of agitated. She was kind of staring, not really focusing, and she kept saying, "I've got to get in line. I've got to get in line." And so he thought she was real confused and didn't know how to interpret that. And so the nurse questioned him and asked a little bit about what he thought that could mean and what she might be worried about, and asked him if he had talked to her about dying, and he hadn't really talked to her specifically about dying. So the nurse suggested that he sit down and ask her what she meant and why, just ask her some questions about that. And it turns out wanting to get in line was she was preparing to die, and they had, in their travels, they had gotten in line so many times, and that was her way of talking about getting ready to die. And And she started talking about Susan is in line, and Susan was her daughter who had died a year or two earlier. And she said, but Frank can't be in the line. Her husband, I think his name was Frank. He can't be in the line. But she was worried about it. And so this led Frank to share with her that he had never told her what his plans were after she died. And she was very concerned about this. So finally he was able to share with her that he was going to live with his son, and they had made a special room for him. And she was able to tell him that he would be okay, that it was all right for her to die. And she immediately, right away, she was able to relax. And then she was able to die a few days later. So that was a real crucial message and led to some crucial sharing that they had together. And this book talks a lot about those kinds of messages that are very, very important. So I highly recommend that. Also, in Practicing Our Faith, there is a chapter on dying well. This is the theme for this summer. And that's really a whole session in itself, so it wasn't anything I could really incorporate into this, into today, but it's very good, as well as the whole book, so I would recommend both of those. I think there have been a lot of experiences in my experience with hospice patients, but it really hit me 2 years ago when every December members of the hospice team do caroling to our hospice patients at home. And most of our patients are at home, and most of them are able to die at home. There is an inpatient unit at Fairview, which is in the rehab facility. It's licensed as a nursing home bed, actually, but it's a subacute unit, so it's an intermediate unit where it's more care than a nursing home and it's less care than the hospital. And people can stay there under private pay or under medical assistance. And they have their own hospice staff, and they're all very good at comfort care and pain and symptom management. So that night we got together to carol, and we always have a meal together, and then we divide up into teams. And my team visited some people at home, and then we went into the inpatient unit. We went to see one patient who was only 5 years old, and we don't have many children in our program, but her mother happened to be a nurse in the home care program, was in charge of the maternal child health department, so we all knew her well. And her little girl was dying of a degenerative brain disease. So we went to their home and sang, and the family was gathered. There was an aunt that was there helping with the children so that the parents could really devote their time to little Mari. And so that was quite a profound time to start out our evening of sharing, and it was sort of a respite for the other two children who were about 7 and 9 years old to have some other action coming into their house at Christmas time, and we had some treats and went on our way. We went to see another patient who was dying of lung disease, and we do in our program, we have any patient that has a life expectancy of less than 6 months, so it can be of any disease entity, as long as we can document and give some sort of prediction that they have less than 6 months to live. So this man was an elderly man who had just come into our program a few weeks earlier. He was actually resting in the back bedroom, so he couldn't come out, but he listened to us sing, and his wife was there, and the Christmas tree lights were blinking, and she was very appreciative of our visit. And we always just kind of sang a variety of songs, but it was always very touching. And now the other patient escapes me, but then we decided to go to the inpatient unit because we had a few patients that were there too. And the one The one patient we went to see had been in our program for a few months, was an elderly woman who was being cared for by her husband at home. And she got to the point where her care was beyond what he could manage. And so she did come into the inpatient unit and was cared for there. And when we went to see her, she was very weak and was barely responsive. And it did appear that she was actively dying and would not live very long. Her husband was in the room and a daughter was in the room. So we sang a few songs and then gentle songs. And then they requested Silent Night, which was one of her very favorites. So I don't even know if I can repeat this, but as we sang Sleep, and we sang the song and then said Sleep in Heavenly Peace. And here she was actively dying. It was just truly holy ground. And she died the next day. So there just have been, you can't believe this, but there just have been a lot of experiences like that. And even though, you know, we may cry with our families, it's just such a rewarding thing to be a part of that journey with them. And we don't cry all the time either. We laugh a lot, as a matter of fact. But I just have to tell you a couple other stories too. They were just very remarkable, and they happened pretty recently. One patient was at home, an elderly gentleman who had cancer, and his course was fairly predictable. I think his family was quite accepting. His wife took care of him at home, and they kind of followed the usual course, a fairly usual course in hospice. The visiting nurse went in on a regular basis, the chaplain visited, and we have a music therapist and a massage therapist, and they stopped, and I'm sure he was getting, our home health aide was stopping to do bathing two or three times a week. And so I remember on a Friday, I heard that when we were giving report to the weekend people, I remember hearing that he was declining rapidly and he might die over the weekend. But on Sunday, he woke up and he was feeling pretty good and he wanted to take a ride. And so his family packed him in the car and they drove to a ways north of Minneapolis where they were from. They visited the old farmstead where he was born. They had lunch with the couple that had stood up for them at their wedding, mm-hmm. and had a good talk, and they just drove around the area and then headed back to Minneapolis, and he died in the car. Mm-hmm. It was just amazing. The family didn't quite know what to do with him, so they went to they did go to an emergency room at a little town where they were near, and then we heard about it through them, and we were able to notify the medical examiner in Minneapolis and Hennepin County, and it was all taken care of. But the family felt really, they weren't upset by that. They felt really good because he had had such a good day and was able to do his life review right in person. So that was a really wonderful experience. Another one that just happened a few weeks ago, we get referrals from the hospital when patients are in the hospital, and they may be coming in and that's the time for a specific symptom, and that's the time when the doctor may say there really isn't any more active treatment we can do for you, so we'd like to refer you to hospice. And so this is a younger man in his early 40s. We got there, and he was actually quite advanced. He was very advanced in his disease. And when we went to do the intake, we looked at him and we saw that he was actively dying, or it appeared that he was. We had gotten the referral that morning, and I think the doctor thought he would go home the next day. So we were going to go there that afternoon and meet with he and his wife and explain all about the program, which we always do, and see if they would be open to hospice support. So we went, and he was far more advanced. I think he had declined quite a bit during the day. And the wife was very determined to bring him home, but we looked at him and thought, he's not going to make it home. He was having periods where he wasn't breathing. He was barely responsive. And so we kind of thought it best just to not to do anything that day because we thought he may die before the next day. The wife was very insistent that she wanted him to die at home. And it's actually quite a bit to put together that fast. And the we agreed to try to do it. He needed oxygen, so the social worker had to really hustle and call the oxygen company and have it delivered to his home, which was like at least 30 minutes out of Minneapolis, a northern suburb. And we weren't able to get a bed there that day, but we could have that delivered the next morning. And we warned his wife that he might not make it home. He might die in the ambulance. And we wanted her to be clear that this could happen, that he might not make it home at all. But she said, I realize that. I really want to bring him home. So all the arrangements were made to be picked up at 7 o'clock that evening after the oxygen had been delivered to his home. And we let the on-call nurse know so she could prepare to go out there that evening to make sure everything was okay. Came to work the next day, and lo and behold, he had made it home. And he kind of woke up when he got home and actually got up. The next day, he was up and he was out on his deck. Mm. And his neighbors were able to come by. His relatives could all come by and tell him goodbye again. He lived for 2 more weeks. Mm-hmm. And we'd just never seen anything like it. On a Sunday, then, his sister left and said, I'll see you Tuesday. And he said, no, you won't. But she didn't really know what to make of that and hugged him goodbye. And the next morning on Monday, he actually went up to go to the bathroom and he fell in the bathroom and his wife was able to help him back to bed. And they called us right away and the nurse went out, but he had died by the time she got there. Yeah. So you just never ever know. I have to tell you another incident that happened just last week. A patient who had come into the hospital because of pneumonia. He had had a heart transplant about 8 years ago and had done pretty well, but he came in the hospital in October with some problems. They did a chest x-ray. He had a lung tumor that was malignant. He was back in December, and it had grown quite a bit, and he was very weak. I can't even remember exactly what they all did in that hospitalization, but they felt that the malignancy was not treatable, and they wanted to try to get him home for Christmas. I think we met with them on the 19th of December, and the goal was to at least give him a few weeks at home. So they agreed. His wife was in a wheelchair. He had actually been her caregiver, so that was very difficult. But they had a son who lived nearby and was going to work with them, was going to help out quite a bit, and another son who was a trucker who did these cross-country stints, but he was going to try to get home over the holidays, so they'd have a lot of family support, and would they be able to do it at home? Well, lo and behold, again, he improved once he got home and made it through the holidays and continued to gain strength. He became quite independent in his ability to care for himself. He had a complication which required some radiation therapy in February, but he decided to go for it because he was doing fairly well. And he had about 15 treatments, and he did well. And then he continued to do well, and so they even decided to give him a little chemotherapy and see if maybe they could shrink his lung tumor. Well, he went to his doctor about 2 weeks ago, and he was quite short of breath. And the doctor admitted him to the hospital right away, and he had quite a severe pneumonia. So he had complications with congestive heart failure, and actually that was, and the pneumonia. It wasn't even so much the cancer. But he was very ill, and they were almost going to put him in the intensive care. But fortunately, his oncologist came by and advised the intern, the residents, that he would be better off staying on the unit. And they did treat him with IV antibiotics, and he did gradually improve. But speaking was very difficult. So he wasn't able to talk very much. But I follow patients sometimes when they're in the hospital. As a coordinator, I end up doing a lot of administration and have a lot of meetings. So I don't always get the patient contact that I like. But I do handle new referrals when they come from the hospital, and I sometimes follow patients. And I happened to have followed him through his whole course when he was in the hospital. And I went to see him on Tuesday, and he was better, but not well enough to go home. He was very determined to get home, but his wife did not want him home until he was able to be a little bit more independent. So we were able to sit down and have a little discussion, and he knew he couldn't go home yet. He was trying to figure out what his future would be, and he knew he wasn't doing well. He didn't know if he'd be eligible to get any more chemotherapy. He started talking about his faith and trying to prepare himself that he would be dying, and so we were talking about dying, and he talked about the fact that his faith had always been a lot of comfort to him. I believe he was Catholic. And he always found a lot of support. So we were having this conversation, and I asked him if he would like me to say the Lord's Prayer with him. And he welcomed that heartily. And so we said the Lord's Prayer together. And then he said, would you be able to say the 23rd Psalm with me? So we did say the 23rd Psalm together. He was able to recite it. He found the air he needed. And again, I hadn't said the 23rd Psalm for a long time or read it. Again, we came to the part, yea, when I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, and I will fear no evil. And again, it was I really felt I was on holy ground again. And he found a great deal of comfort in that and was very appreciative, and then asked for a Bible, which fortunately was in the room, and so I left him reading his Bible. He was transferred to the inpatient unit that day, in the hospice unit, to try to gain a little strength before he could go home. And I saw him again Thursday, right before I came up here, the day we left to come up here. And he was markedly better. He was really, I saw then that he would be able to go home. And the plan was for him to go home this past Monday. I have to tell you one other thing. the other really holy ground scene that I remember well was our music. We had another elderly patient that was discharged from the hospital to go home to go back to a nursing home, and we do follow patients in nursing homes. We consider that their home, and we try to provide all the services there that we would normally provide at home. We don't pay for the room and board, but we send our visiting nurse to be the case manager, and we communicate with the staff in the nursing home, and it supplements what they get. It doesn't take the place of the care they get there. But she was declining quite rapidly, and the music therapist likes to visit patients, especially when they're dying, because it helps them relax and helps them enables them to let go and die and let go peacefully. She knew this patient was declining, and she had been there before, and she went there because she knew that the patient was probably actively dying that day. And she went, and the family was gathered around the bed, and she was singing Amazing Grace, which was one of the patient's favorites, and the patient died while she was singing it. So that doesn't happen too often, but it has happened. So I'm sure a number of you have stories to tell like that, but I just felt I wanted to share some of those to give you an idea. But in order to explain a little bit more about what we provide and how it works, I'd like to just tell you a little bit about Martha and Ed, who Martha was on the women's oncology floor and had advanced ovarian cancer. We got the referral to meet with them and offer the hospice program. She came into the hospital. She'd only had her cancer about 9 months, and she had failed most of her chemotherapy. She came into the hospital to try one more therapy, and she had one treatment in the hospital, but she also developed a fever, and it became clear that they were not going to be able to give any more chemotherapy in the hospital, and that it was time to prepare to go home. And they recognized that they needed help from when they were home before. So we always meet with the family and explain all of what our hospice is all about. We explain that it is for comfort. We don't do aggressive treatment, but we do aggressively treat symptoms so that they can be comfortable. We have a lot of expertise in pain and symptom management. We let them know that if pain is an issue, we will make sure they get what they need to control their pain. There's no limit to that, but that we're not only concerned about the physical symptoms, but we all want to be supportive spiritually and emotionally, and that it is a team approach, and we would have a team that would support them at home. We make sure that the patient knows that we consider the patient to be in charge. We don't come in and tell them what to do, but we offer them everything we can think of, everything we can offer, and then they choose what they want. And the other important thing is that we consider the patient and the family to be together in this, and we treat the family equally of equal concern as that of the patient. So we explained all that and the whole team, all the options that were available, the volunteer, the chaplain, social worker, the visiting nurse would come on a regular basis, the nursing assistant would be available to help with bathing, and again, music therapy and massage therapy. We explain about the equipment that we could put in their home, electric bed, a wheelchair, oxygen, if they needed it. We put in those tray tables where they can eat from, commodes, walkers, pretty much anything they would need to manage at home. And they both agreed, there was a daughter that was there too. We always like to invite all the family members we can to be at that initial meeting. So There was a daughter there too, and we made plans to go home. She was a fairly complicated patient because she had a partial bowel obstruction. She had problems with nausea. She could eat intermittently. Sometimes she couldn't, sometimes she could. And she had an infection in her blood, and she was being treated with antibiotics. So we had to send her, this isn't the usual situation, but we had to send her home getting IV antibiotics and intravenous fluids to give her some hydration. And she had intravenous morphine, which we do occasionally give at home when they can't take it orally, or we can give it orally or rectally or in long-acting form or in concentrated liquid. We can give it a lot of different ways, but for somebody with an obstruction or a potential complete obstruction, it was just better to control her pain with intravenous morphine. And she also had, she was developing a lot of fluid in her abdomen, which was part of her liver failure due to her metastasis to her liver. So she also had this catheter inserted right into her abdominal wall that we could drain the fluid from her abdomen in order to keep her comfortable at home. Well, the one thing about the situation, though, was that the patient knew where she was at. She was getting weaker, and she knew she was going home to die. The husband was still talking about more chemotherapy, and he had, in our interview, he had busied himself a lot with talking about insurance, because his their insurance was kind of complicated. So he was really into getting everything set, but wasn't into talking about what was really happening with her. But it went quite well at home. They had a daily nursing visit because of all the care that she needed. Our chaplain went out and visited, had some really good visits with her and her husband. The music therapist went out and was able to do some life review with her. And that's one really important thing that the music therapist can do. By playing some songs that were familiar to the patient when years ago, it just brings up memories. And even for people who are kind of closed and do not want to talk about anything, it kind of accidentally, they stumble onto conversation through recalling familiar songs. And so that's a very good tool. And the music therapist has a lot of counseling training too, so she's there to talk about whatever the patient needs to talk about.
Jean, I'm curious, does the music therapist sing and play or bring tapes or what?
Well, she brings her keyboard. She's a wonderful singer. Uh-huh. She knows millions of songs.
Uh-huh.
And so she can play about anything, and she tries to learn all different faith traditions too. And sometimes it's very helpful sometimes when there are grandchildren, for instance, and it's hard to get them involved in all the care. They don't know what to make of everything. So sometimes she'll bring a lot of percussion instruments, and it'll be a big family gathering, and she may start out with songs that the kids know, like Barney songs, and so move into it that way. So get everybody involved. And it's a nice way of including everybody in the whole process of what's going on. So
you mentioned there different faiths. That's what I've been curious about. You don't just deal with Christian families, or
no, not at all. In fact, my team is right in Minneapolis, and we go to Minneapolis and St. Paul in all neighborhoods. And it's a wide cultural group, and we've had a number of Hmong patients. In fact, I have to divert real quickly and mention that one Hmong patient, he was an elderly man who was cared for by his son, and a lot of his family didn't even speak English, but the patient didn't. The son did, and he was kind of our translator. But the home health aide was giving him his bath, and she noticed that he suddenly had declined and was probably actively dying. And she alerted the family, and they immediately, you know, got really busy, and they wanted to get his clothes on right away. The home health, they didn't really know. She was kind of perplexed by everything. She called the patient's nurse, and he came right away. By the time he got there, the patient had a suit on and was totally dressed, and he died shortly thereafter. And we learned from that situation that in the Hmong religion that these people practiced, they believed that you entered the next life in what you were wearing when you left this life. And so it was very important to them to get his clothes on so he wouldn't enter.
I imagine that would present some problems if you're trying to deal with their spiritual side as well. If it doesn't coincide with your own, it's very difficult.
Well, that is it. We don't push religion in any way. We take our cues, the chaplain, all of us actually, the chaplain takes their cues from the patient and helps the patient get their own spirituality and whatever is meaningful to them. And it may not be Christian. And, you know, I've been asked, do you try to preach the gospel to a dying patient? And you really can't do that in hospice. We, to people of faith, there is a great, if we share the same faith, there can be a great sharing of faith. But some we cannot force that upon anybody. If the word got out that at Fairview Hospice we were forcing Jesus on people, we just can't do that.
Focus.
Yeah, we can't do that. But that's a very good question, and we've had many different religious faiths represented in our program. Well, in Martha's situation, one of the daughters recognized that the family needed to get together on what was happening with the patient. And one son was coming, there were four children, one son was coming out of town. And you know, those out of town people are always kind of behind in the process because they haven't been there. To walk along with the patient and the people who are there. So the social worker met with the patient and the whole family, and they had a really good session discussing where the patient was at, and of course the patient was included, and they were able to talk about the fact that she wasn't going to be getting more chemotherapy, and they were able to look at, through the session, they were able to begin to look at things a little bit more realistically. Although, you know, people are always vacillating back and forth. One time they can talk about things quite realistically, and the next thing they're going to be talking about something that's happening 9 months away, as though they are going to be there. So it's back and forth in acceptance, which is totally understandable. But then, one day, the patient had quite a bit of problem controlling her symptoms, and she had a lot of nausea and pressure in her abdomen, which was a little hard to manage. But one day the nurse came, and she was feeling much better. Her nausea was gone. She didn't have any pain. The pressure was gone. And they were so happy, the patient and the husband were so happy that she was feeling so much better. But when the nurse examined the patient, she found out the reason right away. She looked at the drainage that was coming from this catheter in her abdomen, and it was apparent by the drainage that her bowel had ruptured. And it had taken away the nausea and the pressure, so it made her feel good. But it was clear that her abdomen, she would develop an infection soon and would die of an infection. So she explained this to the patient, and she said, would you please call my husband in and let him know this? So she did that, and she explained everything that was going on. And then so they they began to prepare, and then they requested another family conference. And so the nurse and the social worker met again with the family and explained everything that was happening. And they began to make funeral arrangements, and the chaplain got involved. And then she died a few days later, but did not. She died very peacefully, and she did not develop an infection, so she died before that happened. Then at the funeral home, often actually the chaplain does do funerals for our patients when they don't have a connection, but these people were connected to their church. And our bereavement coordinator visited the funeral home and met the family, and then the family, the husband particularly, will be followed for a year in our program, in our bereavement follow-up program. And that includes phone contact, and they get newsletters with very timely articles that where they share articles of people who have gone through similar situations, and it's very helpful. We always have a dinner in November, early November, for all the families and the staff and volunteers. And then we have a speaker on how to deal with the holidays. And that's a very nice evening, a difficult evening for families, but also a time that the staff gets to have touch with families again.
I'm trying to get it. I mean, how big is the staff, and how many people can be in the program at any given time?
Okay. Well, we have, with Fairview Hospice, we have two teams, the South team and the North team. And we average around 70 patients, between 70 and 80 patients. And then there is a team in Princeton, Minnesota, which is about an hour north.
And how many staff would take care of 80 people, 70 people?
And then, okay, we have, for 80 people, we have two chaplains, 2.5 social workers, one music therapist, one massage therapist, about the equivalent of 8 full-time nurses. And 5 home health aides full-time. Forgiving baths. We don't provide 24-hour care on a regular basis. And then one music therapist, one massage therapist, 2 patient care coordinators, one for each team, and a program manager. And did I mention? And then volunteers. We have about between 70 and 100 volunteers. And some of them leave for the winter, and they're not all active at one time.
What do they do?
The volunteers would go in. We offer them at least 4 hours a week. They can go in and sit with the families, so that the patients or the family can get away. And so we say the volunteers, they have at least 30 hours of training, and they can do pretty much for the patient what the family would be able to do if the family was there. So if it means helping them to the bathroom or getting them a meal or reading or just being a presence, we promise the patient that if they want to sleep, the volunteer isn't going to talk their arm off. They're not there to keep them awake. But sometimes the patient really enjoys talking to somebody else and not just their a small circle often that is comes to see them or is there in the last months of life. The volunteer could do errands. Sometimes maybe the family isn't comfortable leaving the home, but they may just want to be able to go in another part of the home and sleep for 4 hours, and then the volunteer can be there. So there are a lot of things that the volunteer can do. We don't. Occasionally, they'll transport. They'll take a family member grocery shopping or something like that. We don't. Legally, it's kind of for insurance purposes. like the nurses are not supposed to transport patients. We can't take that liability. We've gotten special permission for the volunteers to do some transporting if necessary.
Jean,
uh-huh.
Because you don't provide 24-hour care, and I think that's often a misunderstanding. I would expect mm-hmm. that in your intake, you do a lot to help the family piece together who's going to be there when and what they need.
Yes. And some people, even after we try to explain it very carefully in the intake, they still have the idea that when they need more help, we're just going to put it in there. But there is one way of getting more help, and that is under the Medicare benefit, and I've got to hurry up here. There is a benefit called continuous care in times of medical crisis. It means that if there is a medical crisis at home, that we can put in 24-hour care at home to get them over the crisis and avoid a hospitalization. And 51% of that has to be by an RN or an LPN. So we can do some skilled care at that time. Like, for instance, pain management, where you're trying to get the right dose of morphine or whatever medication they're on. We need an RN or an LPN to do that. So in situations like that, we can put in 24-hour care. And when they're imminently dying in the last few days, we can come up with enough criteria to call that a medical emergency. And if the family needs more help, we can put in extra help there. We also have some memorial funds that we can tap into. And we often do that to put in some extra help. Like, that's usually by a home health aide, but if a spouse needs to sleep at night, the home health aide will send in a home health aide at night, so a couple nights a week, so that the spouse can get some sleep. Let's see.
Jean?
Yeah.
Could you talk a little bit, maybe you did this before I came in, I mean, what you described sounds so intense. How in the world do all of you deal with the intensity of it?
Well, I've shared the most touching cases with you.
Yes.
But it is intense. And I'm not out there every day either. A lot of my stress just comes from managing the team, but we have a support group that meets once a week, and so we share that way. And that's very intentional, and we go around the circle and people can share whatever they want to. And, you know, even when we hire somebody, we ask, what do you do for self-care? People do have to be tuned into self-care before they even work for us. And we do laugh a lot, we really do. In the office we laugh a lot, and we laugh a lot with families too. You just have to, and they have to. And you know, laughing and crying are very closely connected. So that's real important. We actually have a lot of fun together. I want to explain some of the dilemmas we have, just so you're aware of what's going on. Patients under 65, over 65, are covered under the Medicare hospice benefit. And this has been in effect since 1982. And it's a capitated health plan. It's a managed care health plan where Medicare gives us a daily rate and we pay all the bills. So when a patient comes in hospice, they really don't get any bills, which is very much of a relief to elderly people who are totally confused by all these bills they've been getting. But we get $100 a day from Medicare to have a patient in our program, and we have to pay all the expenses from that. If they go into the hospital, the rate goes up to like $450 a day, but that doesn't nearly cover hospitalization. So they have to go to that's one reason they have to go to our facility. For our program, they have to go to a Fairview facility because we have a contract with them. Our program is only charged for $450 a day, and the hospital has to write off all the costs above that. So it's certainly in the hospital's best interest for us to keep our patients at home. But we don't skimp on that. If they need to go to the hospital, we send them to the hospital. Then we also get another rate for the continuous care in times of medical crisis. We can get reimbursed up to like $550 a day for that. And then there's another benefit called respite care, which means we can admit a patient into the hospital or preferably into our inpatient comfort care unit without medical need. They can come in for up to 5 days just to give the family a break. So that's a wonderful benefit. And if a spouse needs to leave town for some reason, or if a spouse is sick, we could bring that patient in for 5 days. So that is a lot of security to know that's possible. And then the other thing is there are election periods in the benefit. 2 90-day periods and then ongoing 60-day periods. And we have to document at the beginning of each period why a patient is appropriate and that they have why they have less than 6 months to live. And that's very, very tricky. It didn't used to be such a big thing, but in 92 there was some fraud uncovered in Puerto Rico where they had patients on their rolls who were in some cases dead, or in other cases they were, you know, they'd been in the hospice program for way over a year, and this program kept collecting the $100 a day on all those people, so they made quite a bit of money. And there were a few other instances in Florida, I know, too, where this was found to be the case, and so Medicare really tightened up, and they instituted what's called focused medical review. And they periodically can call for charts from different hospice programs and review the charts and determine whether we've documented well enough that this patient had 6 months to live. And they also put out guidelines that help us judge whether they might have 6 months to live, less or less. But it puts us in a very difficult situation because sometimes patients get better when they get in the hospice program because they've gotten good care. And they've kind of put their affairs in order and they kind of relax and they do better. So we actually, if they do too well, we actually have to discharge them. And now that sounds like it could be good news, and in some cases it is. I mean, you can say, hey, it's not a bad deal to be discharged from the hospice program. But some of these people are elderly people, and they've become quite dependent on us. As much as we try to make them as self-sufficient as possible, they've become kind of dependent, and they really need us. And they may not even qualify for regular home care because they don't have enough of a skilled need to warrant a home care nurse coming by on a regular basis. And there are actually, in fact, I was just in St. Louis for a conference, and we met with these people who review these charts. And one nurse got up and said there was a situation in their program where, oh, I should backtrack. The intermediaries are the ones that review these charts. And if they come across a case that they do not think qualifies, they will send a letter to the hospice program and to the patient denying the claim. They did this to a patient in this program, and the patient got the letter before the hospice even realized it. And it denied their claim, and denied this hospice services. And they were devastated because the wife did have cancer, and she did have some disabilities. She just wasn't advancing fast enough. And the husband was having a hard, he was very dependent on the hospice program to help with her care. And they were totally devastated by this. And the patient said to the people in this hospice program, I'm so sorry I didn't die soon enough. And, you know, we all sat there in shock. You know, well, we weren't totally in shock because these things have been happening in all of our programs, but this was just a very dramatic situation. So we are put in this uncomfortable position of having to really predict how long a patient has to live, and that's very difficult. And so there's just been a committee that has studied the whole Medicare benefit and how it works, and they've made the recommendation that they extend the 6 months to 1 year, with the stipulation that the average stay in hospice still is not longer than 6 months. But that would be a huge help. And they've made a number of other recommendations. And we do have people lobbying in Congress and have a lot of people.
Could that family go on private pay at $100 a day and continue the program or not?
Oh, they probably could. Well, this particular program, they were going to keep them in the program and do it under their foundation funds.
How many similar programs to this are there in the Twin Cities? How many hospice programs are there in Minneapolis-St. Paul?
Every hospital is connected to a hospice program. Oh. We have a lot of hospice care. And there are at least six major ones. And then there are some that just go into nursing homes. But unfortunately, one program moved into town recently. It's a for-profit hospice that only goes to nursing homes. That's another area where abuse has been uncovered, because those nursing home patients, they can collect $100 a day there, and it's minimal. It's less care oftentimes than what you do actually provide at home, because they do have the caregivers right there. So so they have uncovered some abuse there. And now this for-profit hospice moves into town, which really irritates me, because we've got enough hospice programs in town that could catch all the nursing home patients. But because in order to make this profitable, or not profitable, just to make ends meet and to be able to hire the help you need, you have to have a big program. A small hospice program does not make it well with the Medicare benefit. And I should explain one more thing. People under 65 covered by insurance, most insurances now mirror the hospice Medicare benefit. At least they do in our area. I don't know about some of these other areas, but they mostly mirror the Medicare benefit. And so we have to follow the same guidelines. And we have to treat everyone the same and provide everything for those people that, for the $100 a day that we provide for Medicare patients.
What do you see on the horizon in regard to things like somebody who's dying and is in a hospice program and wants to be assisted more, like the Dr. Kevorkian type of thing?
Well, hospice programs cannot participate in that, and we always say that. The challenge for hospice programs is to get the word out, and that's why, you know, I appreciate you all coming here today. I'm sure some of you are very familiar, but maybe others of you aren't. We need to get the word out that hospice is available for these people. So that's what we will continue to do, and we will continue to provide comfort care and give them the pain medication they need. On a personal level, there are some patients that don't necessarily fit into hospice that are dying very, very slow deaths at home. You know, ALS patients, Lou Gehrig's disease, although we do have patients with Lou Gehrig's disease in our program, but they really have to be at the very close to the end. Alzheimer's patients, of course. We also do treat them, but in our program, but they, again, we have to document, they have to be very advanced to get into the program. So, you know, hospice doesn't take away the suffering of everybody out there. So, I personally cannot sit in judgment on people that seek to have a peaceful death that don't fit into hospice. But I would never espouse it, or I could never recommend that. But
you ever mentioned AIDS deaths?
We haven't had a lot of AIDS patients in our program. They tend to be, there are certain specialists in the Twin Cities that care for AIDS patients, and they tend to go to certain hospitals. But also, I just spoke with a doctor in our system that deals with a lot of AIDS patients, and we've had some of his referrals, but with the new medications that have come out, it really has put a lot of AIDS patients in remission. In fact, Julianne, my daughter, has a friend who's had been HIV positive since third grade, and now they can hardly detect HIV in her blood. And I asked him, is this really possible? And he said, it is. It's not that it'll ever take it away, but it's possible this can be treated as a real chronic disease. She could live 30 years. Who knows? Who knows? Until another medication came along. So, but that's a whole other challenge, AIDS patients, because there are always...
Have you had much in the past with AIDS?
Well, we had a husband and wife, actually, who both had AIDS that both died in our program. That was a huge challenge. But no, we haven't had a lot in our program. AIDS patients they're looking for aggressive treatment often till the very end, and sometimes they don't fit into our criteria. That is the other challenge that we have, is that there are a lot of patients who are seeking very aggressive treatment, but they are dying and they need help with the process. And they don't necessarily fit under our criteria, and their care is way more than we can pay for with $100 a day. Some of them, their treatment really could be considered what you would call palliative, which you could say for comfort. We have to find ways of helping these people and raise more money in the foundation, for instance, that we can tap into foundation to supplement their care in our program.
One of the ways that we do it, because the AIDS patients are so hard and they are so young and they want aggressive treatment, is they stay in the home infusion team. And then we see them on a regular basis just to do the hospice stuff. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and also we are, and in our program actually, we are going to develop what's called a palliative care team or a bridge team to cover those patients. They don't have to fit in hospice criteria, but the team could be kind of hospice trained to help them deal with those issues, but they can still get the insurance coverage that they need to cover those patients. But there are, especially families with young kids, they know they're dying, but they still want to live as long as they can. And that becomes a dilemma because sometimes it's hard to fit them into the hospice criteria, hospice mode.
Even without your approved extension up to 1 year in the criteria, I assume that if somebody's living longer than 6 months, they just get their care extended.
They can go indefinitely as long as we can document that they're declining.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. They can, these 60-day periods.
Sure.
They can continue to have 60-day periods and stay in the program. Yeah.
Jean, I'm starting to think about a model, and I guess probably somebody's thought of it 100 times before, but of how a congregation can rise to this occasion and be a hospice, non-professional hospice kind of situation. What a wonderful gift that could be in a congregation, not only to help give respite to families, but certainly grow the relationships and the intimacy there, but to get more of us hands-on involved with the dying process. Because I live in such an old age community in Port Angeles and school, I'm thinking that, the average population in school is 55, I mean. So we'll see a lot of that in our community, but the medical profession should die away for too long, and so many of us are so uncomfortable and fearful and think we can't take care of somebody. And of course there's a need for highly skilled RN care in some situations, but a lot of it isn't that skilled. And
yeah.
if we could become comfortable, and if I were to be able to take care of several
help take care of several congregational members. Then when it comes home closer to me, how much more prepared I would be.
Yeah.
And I could just start thinking of how a group, of course, that's not going to take care of people outside of congregations, but what that could do to a group of people who worship the community.
Well, if we could just talk about it more in general, you know, people keep asking for aggressive treatment till the end. I think part of the reason they keep asking is because they haven't had conversations. Their doctor hasn't had the conversation with them to tell them that, you know, you've tried really hard, but I don't think this is going to really be a benefit. Mm-hmm. I would recommend that you work on some other comfort care. But you know, now that our hospital has merged with the university hospital, which is a teaching hospital, and they just keep offering more therapy.
And I think another side of that coin is the question you raised, the whole Kevorkian thing. And I will firmly believe, until someone proves otherwise, that issue comes up because of lack of education. You know that we can manage most things, mm-hmm. and that most people won't feel pushed mm-hmm. to feel like, oh, I gotta get out of this real quick. If they know they'll be well cared for. Mm-hmm. There's exceptions to that, of course, mm-hmm. but.
Mm-hmm. Well, your whole parish nurse program is certainly fitting into what you're saying with the Salt Mama congregations.
Well, we've had a couple of patients that were involved in churches where the church got totally involved and signed up for shifts, and they had people bring some people brought in food, some people just signed up for shifts because they really needed the care at home. That would just be a wonderful learning opportunity in a church when there is somebody that's dying. If somebody could organize that and teach them in that way. So
it seems like what she said in many ways is that it's really a team process, and that there's already a way for, say, congregations to get involved. Maybe a congregation could adopt a certain hospice or whatever if they want to focus it more, but it seems like the rest of that team is needed too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
otherwise,
absolutely.
People who didn't know wouldn't know what to do.
Oh, I see. It completely as an adjunct.
Yeah.
As a gap filler.
It seems like a great thing.
Now the replacement.
Yeah.
I did have a patient die recently who was a older single woman and had a sister-in-law her age come to be with her. But because there was no one else, the little Presbyterian church in Port Angeles did shifts, and they just vigiled with her. And it was just wonderful to watch.
Yeah. Well, thank you all for coming. And again, this is a good education. It's a very easy to read. And if you share this with people in your parish, that would be helpful.
Reading those.
Thank you for coming.
Thank you.
Peter.